And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! And here we are, and it's already Friday, and in fact, it's Friday on the front porch. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn. We call what we do in these parts conversation radio. And Friday on the front porch is a chance to, well, I mean, the conversation is always open topic, open-ended. But maybe we look for things that were maybe a little bit out of the way on Friday on the front porch. Just a chance to kick back and relax and chew the fat, as it were, before the weekend is upon us. I'm in a fairly good mood, resisting the profound urge that seems always to dog them. My beloved Mountaineers were on the road last night, which means that they didn't have their 350-pound blood-soaked lump of coal to rub for luck before they went on the field, and consequently were able to resist the urge to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory and manage to eke out a win by the score of 30-27 over the Bulls of the University of South Florida. I'm sure the emails saying, oh dear God, Bob, you're talking about sports, are going to start any second now. Yeah, but that's okay. That's okay. You want to talk about talking about sports? I got an email for you in a minute. It'll send some people screaming from the room. Others will be sitting there going, yes, yes, absolutely, nod, nod, nod. It is Friday on the front porch, and I've got a couple of emails to share with you that I've wanted to make sure that got to you. One came in this afternoon. A couple came in within the last couple of days. And I wanted to make sure these thoughts made their way to you because, you know, the nature of conversation radio is such that It doesn't always happen via the telephone. We have telephones. We're proud of them. And you use them frequently to make this a much better program than it would be if I were simply sitting here filibustering. But with that in mind, sometimes the conversation goes on in the chat room. Well, it always goes on in the chat room. If you've been to the headonradionetwork.com chat room, if you go there, you'll see a link to Through the Side Door. We've been working on getting that solved, but it isn't solved yet. Yeah, see, it's already started. Our good friend Corey in the Free State of Louisville, who is at this point in time my my avowed enemy. Now, see what the way it shakes out is now. Cincinnati has to beat UConn tomorrow in order for the Mountaineers to go to a BCS bowl game. If UConn beats Cincinnati, then the University of Louisville goes to a BCS bowl game. And consequently, the email that just rolled in said, 2011 Big East champions. Dear Bob, go Huskies. Love, Corey. Love you back, Corey. Go Bearcats. Just saying. So there's that. But no, I've got a couple of dandy good emails, and then some stories, sort of hither and thither, that deserve a little bit of a peek. And of course, your contributions to the overall conversation. First of all, an email just rolled in from Jay and Barb. And this really did engender quite a bit of conversation last night. Preston, our the Horn's resident optimist, called in to take me to task for the way I just can't help feeling about Ed Schultz, and made some very, very cogent points, which I take seriously to heart. But a number of people wrote in, and this is the latest one, Jay and Barb writing in. Hi, Bob. Apparently, I have a similar, because I had said along the way that maybe the fact that Ed just makes me feel kind of is a character flaw on my part. Could be. So Jay and Barb write in. Apparently, I have a similar character flaw. Fat Hetty, well, gives me the creeps, too. I've heard him for years, and as I recall, he used to sound a little different. When he started EQing his voice to sound like Limbaugh, it initiated my gagging reflex. Barb says he became a liberal because the right-wing airwaves were oversaturated. We're all human, I guess. Again, uber appreciative of your many efforts, and to the extent that I pray, I'm praying for your health and strength and the well-being of your family. Dance to the day when the fear is gone. Thanks, Jay. Thanks, Barb. Thank you for the very kind words. And, you know, maybe that's just one of those things where you can't, you kind of can't get over what is off-putting. So, and, you know, I'm an intellect guy. But sometimes there's things that just go on in your gut that make you go, ew. Wasn't there a song that was real popular a while that things that make you go, ugh? No, maybe not. But I did. There are a number of excellent emails, and I wanted to start the program by sharing them with you. And before I do that, to thank those of you who, in the last day or so, have made the effort to get November. Jesus, I need a vacation. Get December off to a good start funding-wise, seeing as how we wound up in a $570 hole for November and another hole for October, and you get the idea. Marty says, split the difference, cheer for a monsoon, wash out the game. Well, it's no fun, Marty. But thank you to all of you who have stepped up to get December off to a good start. It is sincerely appreciated. None of this happens without you. It just doesn't. It may be, what was the phrase Ed Schultz used? Bake sale radio. But it is important enough that you tune in and continue to tune in on a regular basis. And that means a great deal. Maybe when you get to the point where you measure your self-worth in digits and zeros, and maybe you've got 7 decimal places of them or something, maybe it's okay to sneer down your nose and say things like bake sale radio. I hope I never get there. Really. Because that was... That was just another of the things that makes me feel kind of creepy. But anyway, off to the email bag. Because some of these are amazing. Well, they're all 3 amazing. Got a note from Michael in Norway. And, you know, this perspective... It's so valuable. Because those of us here within the confines of the United States tend to look at things as, well, through a glass darkly, certainly. And the perspective we get from people like Michael and Scott and our buddy Robert in Japan and all the various folks, our friends in Canada, all the various folks who... Robert in Australia. We got a lot of people who are willing to share their insight into America as seen from a distance, and it is a much different perspective, I think. Michael wrote the following from Norway. You know, Bob, if you're ever going to be a professional broadcaster, you got to learn to stop touching the microphone and banging on the boom and stuff. I mean, they're never going to pay you that $50 million Limbaugh dollars for, you know, hitting the pop screen. Stop it. So Michael says, this should make free market romantics blush. Will a right winger ever admit that their perception of private enterprise perhaps might be just a little bit overly romanticized? Could something ever happen that would convince a right-winger that privatization is not always a good idea? Is there anything that could make a right-winger admit that things actually got worse as a result of privatization? These are obviously all rhetorical questions with the answers, nope, never, and nothing. Even when it is glaringly obvious that the hunt for ever more profits by private enterprise has a bad impact, a right-winger will always find some sort of scapegoat or excuse why it is never this greedy behavior that's at fault. And, of course, the classic example of that is the 2008 presidential election, when people began to, you know, the entire world began to turn on dim leader George W. Bush. And the first response of the right wing was, well, see, we thought he was a conservative, but it turned out he wasn't. He was just another, he was spending money like a drunken sailor. And that's what you always heard, like a drunken sailor. Funny that they would use a military reference for a guy who dodged the military, but yeah, who the hell am I? Michael continues, let me tell you about one of the biggest mistakes Norway ever made, and the reason why most Norwegians will grumble if you happen to mention energy bills or electricity consumption, namely the utterly stupid decision by our so-called representatives to give in to pressure to privatize the Norwegian electricity infrastructure. A story that should make any free market romantic blush in embarrassment, though somehow that doesn't seem, it never seems to stifle the never-ending rhetoric that public is bad and private is good. Same thing over here with Enron, Michael. Nobody remembers that anymore. Nobody remembers the tape-recorded conversations of Enron traders laughing about making Granny spend her savings to keep her electricity or her gas on. Nobody remembers it. Down the memory hole. Goodbye now. Anyway, says Michael, we have an awesome electricity infrastructure in Norway that actually is almost all green. Due to the Norwegian landscape, we were and still could have been entirely self-sufficient with electricity, as our mountainous regions and coastal placement gives us plenty of water, rivers, and lakes to run our turbines. This infrastructure was built with our tax money during a time of great poverty in this country, after the Second World War, and before we struck oil. Electricity used to be cheap when Norway became water-powered, and nobody feared the electricity bill, which used to be less than the phone bill. The grid was also fairly efficient, even though sometimes there were short blackouts due to weather. Though rarely did such outages last very long, as the public power company did a fine job of locating and fixing any broken power lines. Even though electricity was cheap, it did afford us a surplus that was enough to cover the cost of maintaining both the grid and the power stations. In short, our power infrastructure was very cost-efficient and worked just fine. However, voices on the right kept focusing on and scandalizing some instances of less-than-efficient use of our resources, feeding off the frustration people felt whenever there were periods with many power outages, claiming that this would not happen nearly as often and would be dealt with so much more quickly if run by a private company. Even silly stories about the alleged lack of cleanliness at certain power stations were attributed to it being public, asserting that a private company would have hired a cleaning staff to keep things nice. Of course, it was also argued that electricity would become even cheaper, as competition would ensure an even better deal for us consumers. You know, the miracle of the market, right? Eventually, the Norwegian electricity infrastructure was privatized region by region till all of it was either partially privatized or entirely in private hands. What previous generations had built with their hard-earned money and labor was sold for a fraction of its value to private investors. Just remember, they want it all, and what they can't get from you voluntarily, they will take from you by force. The 1%. I remember when our power station got privatized in my hometown. It was sold to the highest bidder, but already the year after the newly formed private company could show profits of twice that amount. A new elite of people became instantly rich, which according to right-wingers proved the success of privatization. Even though posting record profits year after year, the price of electricity went up rather than down. Every winter it skyrocketed to new heights as the companies claimed they were running at maximum capacity, and every summer it went down a little bit less. When the electricity bills were starting to approach outrageous, it split into two bills rather than the usual one. One bill for the amount of electricity consumed and another bill for grid rental, which apparently was for maintaining the grid. Man. This separation of the amount into two bills came about as a result of relentless lobbying of our representatives, who ended up sanctioning an extra charge for grid rental, which made it temporarily look like the electricity prices had dropped. At first, this amount was a fraction of the combined electricity charge. However, it just kept on growing with the blessing of our politicians. Soon, we had to pay just as much for grid rental as we did for the actual kilowatt hours consumed. While this was going on, the power companies had started expanding the grids going over the border, spending the money we put in for grid rental to make power lines go abroad. something which eventually leads us to the utterly stupid situation Norway is in right now. When our water reservoirs are filled to capacity, our power companies are exporting electricity out of the country, making a nice extra profit for themselves, or in the cases of partial privatization, themselves and the community. Therefore, when winter comes around, our water reservoirs are quite depleted, so electricity has to be imported from Europe, leading to new spikes in electricity prices every winter. Quite literally, the power companies are selling cheap power to other countries every spring, summer, and fall, while buying expensive power from abroad every winter, letting us consumers take the brunt of the extra cost. See, I read this and I scratched my little head and I said, wait a minute, I don't speak Norwegian, because this is the life we lead here in Appalachia, where they tell us things like, coal keeps lights on, and coal provides America's cheapest energy resources. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I think our power bill has gone up over 100% in the last 4 years here because of that clean coal that's so cheap. Winter's coming and I'm scared. Because, and it's not just me, and it's not because we are profligate users of electricity. I am an absolute authoritarian fanatic about turning the lights out in empty rooms. But it is nothing for us to see a $500 power bill in a given month. Nor my neighbors. People were shocked and stunned, stymied, dumbstruck last winter when they started seeing those things. And yet the rate increases, they keep getting the rate increases, and the service doesn't get any better. Just saying. So Michael goes on and says, just today, we could read in our newspapers here in Norway how our water reservoirs are currently filled to capacity yet again, and how we essentially, with this, could produce enough electricity for an entire year's worth of energy consumption in Norway. That's right. Norway could go an entire year without importing one single kilowatt hour just off of the water we have accumulated thus far. It would even be cheap. However, this does not benefit us Norwegians, as most of this energy is currently being sold so the companies can make some more billions, and when it's all gone, we, the consumers, will have to pay the high price of electricity imported from Europe yet again. All while we could have been 100% self-sufficient without much effort at all. And you know, that's the way privatization works. We've got a water bill here. And it's a water bill that we get because so-called city water was extended to us a few years ago. And then the public water company was immediately sold for cheap to West Virginia American Water Company, who in turn, well, you know the story. And again, that bill keeps going up and up and up and up. Even though our water usage is consistent, and even though the water services are no better that one year than they were the year before, because they're servicing those shareholders and paying bonuses to 1% CEOs. Servicing shareholders, that's just a polite way of it. You know what I'm talking about. So Michael concludes, wouldn't you think this gigantic failure would be reason for right-wingers to admit being just a little bit wrong? Of course not. This type of business practice is just to be expected, and it would be wrong of Norwegian authorities to try to inhibit these companies from making such profits in this way. Instead, they point to our environmental regulatory agencies, claiming they are imposing regulations and fees that could cost the company so much money they have to extract this from us consumers. That's right, the problem isn't the greed of these immensely profitable energy companies. Rather, it is governmental regulations that are making our bills so expensive. What utter hogwash. And it is. Thank you very much, Michael, for that explanation and that bit of outreach, so that we may see that it's not just in the United States that the psychotic priests who worship at the altar of unholy profit, it's not just in the United States that they build their temples. I mean, okay, so I've never been there, and probably never will. But but unless I miss my guess, being as how it is on planet Earth, the wind does blow in Norway, right, Michael? You could dot your hillsides with wind turbines and... Oh, right. And eventually they will, when the huge corporations decide that they can gouge more money out of more Norwegians and sell more on the free energy market. Free market energy. And the funny thing is, the bills will never decrease. And this, since we've got a Norway letter, let's do a Sweden letter, because we've had a correspondence from our good buddy Scott, who apparently is feeling a bit introspective, and said, is there really anything as pathetic as premeditated grousing? Is conspiracy to be churlish a crime? Maybe it's just late-onset culture shock. While convalescing from knee surgery, you know, you need to write and tell us these things are happening, Scott, so we can all sort of at least send our best thoughts for you. While convalescing from knee surgery, pain relief medication being by definition a mind-altering substance, I found I was unable to catch up on my serious reading, biology, principles of climatology, geomorphology, a radical history of Britain. Yes, I'm a total egghead and read college textbooks. However, as said, my mind was a bit too befuddled to make much sense of what I was reading, so I figured what would make less sense than watching something senseless, namely American college football. See, I'm having my effect. As I was under strict medical instructions to keep my leg elevated on the couch or a tabletop, and feeling a slight touch of nostalgia for my youth when I used to enjoy college football, aided in that direction by some of the comments heard this time of year on the horn, which led me to believe it at least worth a second chance a quarter of a century later, I ended up watching way too much gridiron, as the game is known outside of the U.S., because they don't call it football. They own that word, you know, they invented it. And what did I discover, says Scott, other than the fact that long sentences such as the current one are a signature of the long half-lives of certain potent analgesics, the game of gridiron can be safely ignored, but the cultural institution that is American football awakened my egg-headedness out from its palliative pallor and smack into full-blown cultural anthropology mode. Sorry, that was... Wow. Now, I'm forever noting that when we happen to mention sports on this program, it's not because I feel like I can do a better job than, say, Dan Patrick, who does a brilliant job in his own right. He's a master of the art. But because there are things within it that liberals and progressives would do well to embrace and or at least become conversant with, so that we're not just completely left behind in the dust. Did you see that Michigan-Ohio State game last weekend? Why, no, I didn't. I was busy that day. I was shopping for some rare imported Botswanan velvet to make doilies with. Eco-friendly doilies. I'm not being an ass here about Botswanan velvet eco-friendly doilies. It's not the point. It's just that if we would understand what's going on here, we have to at least make a passing attempt to see where the zeitgeist lies. You know what I mean? So Scott, warmed and ensconced in a palliative analgesic cocoon, shall we say, continues, yes, I confess that over the past decade or two, I have seen the occasional Big Ten football game sent to me by my aging parents on videotape, but this is the first time I have seen some of these southern schools since I immigrated and since acquiring a new cultural perspective. Uh-oh. All right, everybody behind the cornbread curtain, just put the guns down. It's all right. Is willful curmudgeonry allowed on the horn? Why, yes, Scott, yes, it is. If so, what is it with Southern football? I remember cheerleaders from way back when in Northern Ohio, but what is it with the scantily clad female platoons, companies, regiments, divisions of flag wavers and baton twirlers? Has pole dancing gone ambulatory? What year is it back in the U.S.? When I left the U.S., women were in the process of self-liberation. My wife tried watching a little of this and just shook her head and left. And what is it with the LSU marching band sitting up in the bleachers with their baton twirlers spaced evenly in front of the band like the columns on an old plantation house? But, of course, the imagery is not as much of columns as it is of Vestal, wink, wink, virgins. Those, Scott, are the LSU Golden Girls. Ain't they pretty? And then there's South Carolina, whose marching band apparently knows exactly... See, I'm going to get an email from the South Carolina. All right, David in South Carolina. Easy there, liberal in South Carolina. Just take the critique for what it is. And then there's South Carolina, whose marching band apparently knows exactly three different notes. One of them repeated, but all three repeated ad nauseum. Is this the marching band equivalent of trance? Ride, 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 Ziato Bon. Whoops, that's two notes too many. Carolina has gone minimalist on Kraftwerk. And when that Gamecock marching band is finally mercifully quiet, the loudspeakers blare out some sort of New Age synthesized total anesthesia, also consisting of exactly three notes, one repeated, but not exactly the same three tones as the band. Monotony loves minor variation, I guess. I sent an email to the marching band to encourage them that seeing how they were so very proficient with three notes they already knew, and perhaps too well, that the time had surely come to teach them five new notes so that they might be able to play an entire scale, and next year they can work on sharps and flats and even minor and major keys, and who knows, maybe someday be ready to attempt to commit music. I tried to keep the tone of the email very positive, but it was hard. Oh, a dear, a female... and why is there... Now, remembering, we're listening to deliberate curmudgeonry here, all right? And why is there always are there always military guys on the sidelines? At some schools, it seems to be de rigueur to do push-ups for every point the team scores, and to keep doing push-ups every time they score, recounting the former points with each score, all in some great macho display of he-manship, as if, given an economy gone to hell and future employment for the graduates a chancy venture at best, at least the rough and tough manly ROTC cadres can prove America's moral superiority over all comers by being able to do more push-ups than any other ROTC in any country also playing gridiron. That's going to be a pretty small subset, Scott. Just saying. And now that I am deeply into bitch whine and complain mode, when did students quit doing local school-specific cheers and start doing the same guttural chants as does every other school to recorded music over the PA system? Cheerleaders were always bad enough, but they had a local angle. But what corporate honcho is deciding when to turn on the two-minute hate cum rah-rah? And what is with the small white towels everybody waves in circles? I suppose these are the new pom-poms, but why does every school have them? And why white when schools have their own color schemes? Is there some sort of symbolism or cult belief I'm missing? And I do not understand how they achieve such conformity in getting everyone, apparently, to dress up in the school colors so that everybody is perfectly regimented. I mean, in a free society, why would you allow yourself to be told what to wear? It is as if people have sublimated their natural variation and have replaced it with uniform public displays of team spirit. And what is that half of an infinity sign or alpha turned 90 degrees on each side of the 50-yard line? A tribute to fraternities and sororities? I'm going to have to sort that one out. I might need a picture, Scott. And every football game I saw had this totally bizarre, clearly mandatory 20-second spot where the cheerleaders have been told to stand closely together in front of a camera and told supposedly to show maximum school spirit, which they do by babbling incoherently with the exactly same incoherent babble as every other school's cheerleaders. Speaking in tongues training? In Cervantes' time, the dog's moment of fame lasted all day. Here it's at most 20 seconds, and each babble fest is exactly like the preceding one as will be the next. And whatever happened to adverbs? Adverbs? What about Naomi? Does no one in America remember the difference between the word good and the word well? No, Scott, they don't. And what sort of word is athleticism? Who coined that? And why would anybody in their right mind repeat it? Oh, Scott, I think you're hooked. See, half the time I'm watching college football just to listen to what gets done to the language by the babbling babbleheads in the booth. Well, Keith, he's a fine young Christian man with great athleticism, and he plays real good. And finally, we come to Texas versus Texas A&M. Is Halloween a lifestyle now? What self-respecting young adult would join the University of Texas marching band knowing that they had to wear a red, overly stereotypic Western-style shirt? That's burnt orange! With white leather tassels and a white 10-gallon hat, unless predisposition to kinkiness was as an acceptance criterion on the application form. But they're nothing in comparison with the Texas A&M student body, which looks like some sort of arrested development post-World War II pseudo-U.S. Forest Service. Military uniform fetishism. You know, I've thought a lot of things about Texas A&M University. And those silly-ass uniforms with their dumb-ass Sam Brown belts and their godforsaken stupid boots. But never, and maybe one needs pain meds to do it, never have I all gotten all the way to some sort of arrested development post-World War II pseudo-U.S. Forest Service military uniform fetishism. We're keeping you on the pills, Scott. I'm sorry. We just are. I mean, I'll take Scott's foray into heavy pain medication any day as compared to the one that... You remember when Glenn Beck got butt surgery and had this sort of hallucinatory blab fest into a webcam? This is a lot more fun. These garish uniforms, Scott continues, and here we're talking about the fans, not the team, have braid on the shoulders, merit badges sewn on the shoulders, or perhaps it's some sort of military ribbon, although neither explanation is at all satisfactory. White patent leather belts, knee-high riding boots, shaved heads. For all the world, it looked like a place that caters to those with a need to dress up in 60-year-old military kit. It's as close to 1920s, 1930s fascist fashion as I can fathom. It's not an official military academy, right? Well, kinda yeah, kinda no. So what is it, really? I'm asking, is it there to guard the border against the return of Santa Ana? Well, if you said return of Santa Ana in College Station, Texas, they'd say, he left! But the overdose of gridiron did have one positive effect, Scott says. Knee be damned, I ran away from the couch 2 days early, and no limp or lameness will ever get me back in front of the tube for another dose of that. A person can stand only so much anthropologic field work. Don't kid yourself, Scott. We've got you. You're hooked. You're going to tune in. You're going to tune in for the same reason that people who know better turn on the Kardashians, okay? You're going to do it. And it's okay. You don't have to feel bad about yourself. And frankly, if I can get more phrases like arrested development post-World War II pseudo-U.S. Forest Service military uniform fetishism out of it, by God, we'll strap you in like robot chicken. Just saying. But again, how do you walk away from that kind of commentary? And then this, greetings from Northern Ontario, coming from Raymond, or not. Hi, Bob. My name is Sean. Sometimes you guys confuse me with the emails. And I'm a school teacher working on a First Nations reservation in Northern Ontario. I listen to your show often and confess a real morbid fascination with American politics. Well, that's really the only fascination you can have, Sean. Because American politics is pretty daggum morbid. A topic I think worthy of discussion on your show, so listen up, everybody. Jot this down. This could be good Friday on the front porch material. A topic I think worthy of discussion on your show, as well as Mike Malloy's, is the stunning reality that many citizens in your country continuously support Republican cretins with their votes in spite of glaring gaps in both common knowledge and even basic human decency. That's why they're Republicans. From a Canadian perspective, it is endlessly amazing that creatures like Newt Gingrich, Michelle Bachmann, Rick Perry, and so on continue to surface and enjoy a broad base of support and success. Fox News is always number one in cable news ratings, and the figures mentioned above would be laughed out of most areas of political life in this country, to wit, Canada. What I'm getting at is, why the hell do so many individuals in your country mindlessly back the right wing in the face of the most obvious realities? The Republican Congress has stymied every single measure Obama has put forth, and then subsequently they blame his administration for the woeful state of the economy, yet the electorate fall for this idiocy lock, stock, and barrel. Perhaps the cold reality is that America... Oh, pay attention here, going back to the beginning of this sentence. Perhaps the cold reality is that America is not intelligent enough for democracy to succeed? And I think there's an element of that. You must also understand that Fox News has the highest news ratings of any cable news organization, bearing in mind, of course, they're still lagging far behind SpongeBob SquarePants. Because the audience that they're reeling in is the audience that is there. Fox News has an audience of people who sit and stare sort of Clockwork Orange-like into the TV screen, wanting to scream, but somehow silenced, horrified, terrified that the liberals have a war on Christmas. Did you hear that, Marvelline? Honest to Pete, I got wished happy holidays in a big box store recently by an employer, but just by somebody who happened to, and I about kissed her for wishing me happy holidays instead of have a blessed Jesus-centered Christmas. There's a lot in Sean's email here. It's the same sort of question that's covered in What's the Matter with Kansas, for instance. And it's also addressed by that study that I mentioned last night that came out from Fairleigh Dickinson University that shows that people who don't watch news at all have a better understanding of the factual basis of the news than people who watch Fox. Perhaps it's best understood by noting that Fox News, if they thought that there was a demographic there for watching moose shearing, Rupert Murdoch would have a moose shearing channel so that he could advertise crap on it. Because this is not news. Maybe it's been too long since I mentioned this, but Fox News is a brand name, not a commentary on reality. Fox News is like Lucky Charms breakfast cereal. There are no Lucky Charms in Lucky Charms, and there's no news in Fox News. They're just brand names. And frankly, Lucky Charms, for as sugary and nasty as it is, may actually be less harmful than Fox News, otherwise known in these parts as Radio Rwanda. So thanks, Sean. Thanks for the note from Northern Ontario. Much, much obliged. Much appreciated. Like I said, we've got a bunch of stuff to go into. We'll take a little break and come back, just because I can't get an email from Northern Ontario without playing this. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Comfort memory to spare. In my mind, I still need a place to go. All my changes were there. Blue, blue windows behind the stars. Yellow moon on the rise. Big birds flying across the sky. Throwing shadows on our eyes. Leave us helpless, helpless, helpless. Hey, hear me now. The chains are long tied across the door.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95.
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
No, it's not Kraftwerk. Minutes before the hour. Friday on the Front Porch continues on the horn. Yeah, that's... I'm an old 70s corporate rock geek. Yeah, sure. Oh, that was Kansas. David in Tennessee. Subject line, the Texas A&M takedown. Utterly perfect. Now, for those of us with a passing acquaintance with military training grads, there is a universally held opinion to which I offer. The real military academy grads are usually well-balanced and not eager to act, as did General Patton. The ROTC products of 4 years of wearing the student prince costumes at Texas A&M, well, just play back the footage of Robert Duvall on the beach praising the scent of napalm in the morning to get the picture of their self-aggrandizing asshat grads from down College Station way. And, it, you know, it's got to feel, as somebody who follows a lot of SEC football, it's got to feel so good to know that Texas A&M is coming to the SEC East. So much for, well, so much for geography, huh? Then this from Mark. All of that is how we denationalize, deculturize, and remilitarize anyone watching or playing the game. It's so subtle. I've chosen LSU over Alabama because New Orleans was so short on public school teachers they... New Orleans imported public school teachers from old New York City. Plus, they're partying Catholics. Sign Mark. And I go back and forth. I don't like Les Miles. The man does miracle math made easy. Kids got some dirty doings going on. The kid's supposed to get bounced for two games. Les does some miracle math made easy. Decides that it's 1.8 and then rounds down to 1, and the kid never misses a lick. You know what I mean. I promise we're pretty much done with football. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. It's Maura.
Well, hey, Maura.
How are you this evening?
Pretty good, I think.
I called to say how excited I am. I found out I can marry in all 50 states being a lesbian. Michelle Bachman told me how.
Really?
Yeah, I'd start to marry a man.
Darn.
Isn't that exciting?
gay people can get married in all 50 states as long as they marry a heterosexual person of the opposite
sex.
Right.
She has got to be as dumb as a box of rocks.
Or, to quote that recent email that I'm so fond of, dumber than a bag of hair.
Yeah, really?
And she kind of is she's a skin bag of hair. She's awful, just
awful. I'm trying to figure out why she said that. Because she has a husband that married, she married a gay man.
Well, and it's working out for them, isn't it?
Exactly. So why not share the happiness?
I'm always glad whenever anybody mentions Marcus Bachman, because I get to say that if he was any further in the closet, he'd be riding a lion through Narnia. That's one of my favorite lines of the year, Maura.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, have you decided which of the 50 states you're going to go and get gay married to a heterosexual man in?
I think I really want to go way deep south behind the corn-bread curtain, because it's so, welcoming to the gay community.
Absolutely, and you're going to love the hoop skirts, Maura.
Oh, I'm just going to look so good in a corset.
Now, you just stand still, Miss Scarlett.
God help me.
God help us all, Maura.
Listen, have a great weekend.
You too, you too. Thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
Enjoy the nuptials.
Thank you.
Bye. Oh, yeah, we're going to have gay marriage all over the country. It's just that there's only going to be one gay person in the marriage. Onward. Welcome to the program.
Good evening on this Friday.
Hey, David, what's happening?
Not much. I'm just listening to about the football talk and the uniforms, and I would say that the same thing goes for the military. And I think a big part of that is why we have synchronized drills, why we have these rituals of twirling guns and that go on for hours and hours. It's just to fill time, so that the academy can say, "Wow, we got this schedule filled."
And then, of course, you know, you can't have any sort of significant football contest without wasting however many hundreds of gallons of Jet A with, you know, jets flying over and ruining people's eardrums.
Yeah, that's the other thing. I think football, though, they've got it down to a science of how to make people spend 4 hours on an afternoon on one game when really... take out the commercials, and you would be so much better for it. If there ever was a way to take out the commercial, a lot of the NFL football players, these broadcasters would be scared. They'd be like, "Wait a minute, we can't compete with football without commercials."
Well, half of the guys you listen to calling NFL games, at least on the TV, radio right. people are an entirely separate breed, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have to bring the game to life via their own words. Half of the guys doing football play-by-play on the TV box could be replaced by a monkey and a dog.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We keep bringing sports up and how heavy it is in our culture. I went to a furniture store on Wednesday, and it was like Orwellian because all of the channels were on one channel on ESPN, and it wasn't even sports. It was sports talk, and they were like, "So tell us what the Big Dan's going to be," and it was like echoing all around me. It's like, this is surreal.
Right, and after a while, you feel like, again, it feels like you're in Clockwork Orange and strapped in the chair.
Right, right, and then that's what people start to. It starts to become this. Using this complete anesthetic this complete induced drug that everyone is so interested in this, and they don't know why. What's the Big Ten going to be? Because I mean, you can't escape it in Maine, the talk of sports, and I have no problem with sports. The problem I have is the emphasis has hammered it so much that the arts does not stand a chance. Because I'm always a prevailing on the arts, and I'm a little bit of conspiracy theorist when it comes to that, because it's so easy to monetize this game, just like you wouldn't believe, where it's harder to monetize other sports or other arts rather, and they're just like, well, how do we get this off the network? Again, I have no problem with football people. It's just I've seen what's happened to the arts because we put such an emphasis on sports all the time, especially monetized sports.
And frankly, I guess they always will. It's too damn big a business.
Oh, I know. I mean,
you've got God knows how many little boys who can look back on their childhood being stolen from them by a monster like Jerry Sandusky. Because we didn't dare rock the boat because football was too big a bit. It was too economically important to the Happy Valley of Pennsylvania.
Right, and I think that's why, you know, there's such an interest in shows like Dancing with the Stars and stuff like that, because it is that little drips and drabs of culture and arts, no matter how karaoke style it is. I think we underestimate people's interest when it comes to what America would be interested in. It would take some conditioning over time, a few decades. But America, I fully believe that it would be interested in the arts, especially with forms of dance and poetry and all of that. Yeah, you would have to go through that last period, no question about it. But the fact that we just shrug it off. You know, it's similar to how radio plays are so big in BBC and radio theater, and we just completely just said, nope, no more.
And there used to be a few manifestations of that. Maybe there still are. It's just so few radio stations run it. The Mutual Broadcasting System used to have some radio dramas that still remained. Maybe they've been long gone. I used to have a dream of having the Horn Radio Theater of the Air, in which we would all pull together MP3 files, for instance, of a Shakespeare play.
Right.
And we would just mix them all. We would mix them all down to one thing. And you know, would there be an audience for that? I don't know. But people go out. Obviously, the bars are still full. Musicians are still performing. The mimes are still on the streets in San Francisco, as far as I know. Mimes. But again, it can't be monetized. You know, you think of a brilliant ancient culture like that of the former Soviet Union, where people actively sit in parks and watch people play chess.
Right.
And it's engaging, and of course all the great chess players are Russians or from one of the former Soviet republics. But see, none of the for-profit 1% media have figured out how to make a big buck and sell Budweiser with it.
Well, you know, that's the other interesting thing, is because so many people have gone completely money crazy, and that includes our own citizens, and they don't know why. They just suddenly it's programmed that they need it, and there is no concept of their own when mortality has hit, all of your acquiring all of this wealth that's not really wealth, and you're not going to be able to carry it. What exactly did you do with your time? And the fact that we immerse all of our citizens like that. You know, Bob, I was watching last night a documentary, or rather a biography on the Troutman brothers, of Zapp and Roger, and they were talking about Dayton, Ohio. And this is the interesting thing, because a lot of people don't know the history of Dayton, Ohio, and Zapp and all of that. They just know that it was Roger Troutman popularized the bass sound coming out of the Lowriders, and was basically the architect for West Coast hip hop, and he was basically the pioneer of the talk box and dance music, and especially funk. But one of the things they talked about was the fact that after the music, now get this, Bob, I found this like absolutely insane and crazy. He came from a family of 10 children, and they lived together all in one bedroom, and they showed the house. And the dad said they didn't put any limitations on him. What I was telling you about before, about how you can do this, you can do what you want. They didn't tell him that they were poor or anything. But here's the thing about it: they became the band and they're successful. But they were taught from an early age to invest back in their community. So what they did was they started up an organization called Troutman Enterprises, and this is so goddamn crazy. Because and this is where we can take this country, I believe, in plans like this. But what they did was they took all the millions of dollars they made. I mean, they had number one hit after number one hit after number one hit, and they took all of that money and they invested it back into Dayton, Ohio, and they started building low-income houses for people that just wanted houses. They couldn't get electrician, they couldn't get anything, so they had all these sisters and brothers and nephews and the guy that was responsible for it, Larry Troutman. What he would do was someone would say, well, we can't get an electrician. He goes, well, I guess, sis, you're going to have to get certified. So they would make her go to school and he'd get certified. The crazy thing about this is the crazy thing about it. They would wake up at, now keep in mind, this is a band, ladies and gentlemen. This is a band. They would wake up at 5 a.m. in the morning building houses. And then they would go to practice at like 8 to like 10 to 2. Now, when I say 10 to 2, I'm saying 10 p.m. to 2 a.m., and then they would get up 5 a.m. in the morning. Now, here's the amazing fun fact about all of this while I'm saying this. They built more houses, did more for Dayton, Ohio, than the federal government ever lifted their finger for.
Wow.
The whole community. And see, this is what I'm talking about. This is the power of just those types of ideas and where investments can bring you. And the crazy thing about it, here's the interesting thing that he said, is that those brothers knew, or rather Larry Troutman knew, and he knew that, he said, these homes are going to last longer than our music, and they're going to be more important to the community in which we live in.
And that's a case of people sort of taking matters into their own hands. But the question always remains, why does that have to happen? To a certain degree, David, that's an example not just of individual determination, doing the right thing, and so forth, but it's also a picture of failed, dysfunctional government. You know, it's sort of like the story last night about the Binghamton, New York mayor who's going to try to make sure that water gets to these folks in Susquehanna County, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
On the one hand, you say, yes, 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 that's how it's supposed to work. And on the other, you look at the court system that has let these 11 families be completely ripped off, abused, violated by Cabot Oil and Gas, and you say, but that's proof that the system has been perverted and twisted beyond all recognition.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think what I was just mentioning there was just the complete essence of what community organizing is all about. And I do believe government has a role in all of that. But I think the biggest problem that we're facing, Bob, is these promises that are never met, and the fact that it takes the discipline and work ethic to do that, and to constantly do that over and over and over again for one set of a community. And I just don't, personally, I don't think that the I think there's a bigger reason why the federal government doesn't get involved with these communities like that, because it is that kind of work, it is that kind of ethic, and it is that kind of focus. And
the government is run at the very top in the House, the Senate, and by one percenters.
Right.
What the hell do they care about a family needing a house? They're the 1%. Maybe that's an oversimplification, David.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, but I think basically that's what's going to have to come down to, where a lot of communities are going to have to get together and start planning from the ground up. Because I think the whole political situation and waiting and just hoping for something to just do a turnaround and getting involved in elections, that's great and all, but I think the bottom line is that it's going to have to take a different direction. It's going to have to take a different turn. I mean, we can see how hard it is to get things done on a level of where we see it to be acceptable, and it's tough to come to that conclusion. And it takes, you know, I know a lot of people are really, really gung-ho about the political solution and the politics and the Democrats and all of that. But really what it's going to really take is getting certified as an electrician and starting to get out there and do it. Because I think there's just so much there's only so much you can juggle, Bob. That's where we're at now. There's only so much you can juggle.
If we work from the paradigm that you and I set forth a couple of nights ago,
yeah,
that this is not a coming unsustainability, but this is a present case of unsustainability, then yes, people are going to have to become multi-talented generalists. I would be far better off if I could do something besides write about stuff and talk behind a microphone. You know, if I was a competent plumber or cabinet maker or carpenter, and somewhere along the lines, I guess I'm going to be teaching myself some of that stuff.
Right.
But Lord God, the learning curve is hell.
I understand that. I think the problem is that as things get worse, we're going to be led into that direction. I can already see it where I live, and the economic conditions that are coming our way. And again, you're completely right about the 1% running government, but it begs the question: how do you get the 1%? How do you extract the 1% out of government?
And that's a huge question. On the one hand, the obvious answer is electoral politics. But our side,
we need to do
a much better job of explaining what it is we believe in to Americans sitting on their couches in their living rooms. Because we run into it from time to time. We tend to think that we here in the Horn family, for instance, we take the way that we look at the world and the degree to which we are engaged, and we extrapolate that into the rest of America, and it's just not true. The disconnect that our buddy liberal in South Carolina felt in talking about those NASCAR fans who booed American veterans along with Jill Biden and Michelle Obama. That is a disconnect. I can't imagine doing that. But they can, because they did. The disconnect in Alabama stand, David.
Yeah.
People who elect representatives who enact things like HB 56 that is literally destroying the state before people's very eyes. Yeah, but I'm going to vote for him again because he's got family values. How do you deal with that without psychotropic medications? Because
really,
I'm stumped.
I think the hard part is that in order to get to a temporary fix or a miracle, if a miracle is by and there is a God, a solution, you continue the conversation. What you're doing right now, you keep talking, you keep hammering, and you keep sculpting till you get to something that is a suitable answer for the situation we find ourselves in.
But it becomes so frustrating that, I think back to Sandra's laughing statement last night of, maybe I'll just go to Costa Rica and not come back.
One of the things I do, Bob, one of the things I do is I always like to hyper-exaggerate in the situation I am, where I find myself at a rut. And I find this to be a helpful tool. Like I say, tomorrow my business is gonna go under. I'm gonna be in jail, and I go to such lengths that it's like that will never happen. And I think to an extent, where we're at right now, where a lot of people are concerned, I think you have to. If you look around the world and in comparison, yes, we are down, but we're not out. In the respect that we can get things working as a progressive society, community, collective, whatever you want to call this togetherness that we have in the U.S. and in the world, I think with the tools that we're given now, we can go more forward to that direction. But again, we have to keep our eye on the ball. Is that where we constantly talk and we constantly hammer and sculpt ideas and points and insights together, this is how we stitch what we will see as the new America coming forward. But yes, it is gonna, I do believe it is gonna have to be that moment where we look at the clock and we see it's 5 a.m. and we're like, yeah, we gotta start building something. Yeah, I think we're approaching that when it gets that dire. Because there's so much corruption that, yeah, we're going to have to be on the same page where maybe someday we'll be having to have Skype conferences all across from community to community and spending, like, hours and hours and talking in a sort of way like how the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence came to be, but in a digital format.
And, there are efforts like that going on. For instance, I think there's a sort of open-source procedure taking place or took place in the crafting of the new Icelandic constitution.
Right.
It was done open source. It was edited online, sort of, I don't know, it seemed kind of wiki style, if you know what I mean.
Right.
And there are all of these things that are going to have to be invented along the way because, it's like I said about the law a couple of nights ago, the law always lags behind human experience. And to a certain extent, so does everything else. I mean, obviously, economics are lagging behind human experience. Because we are seeing before our very eyes right now, David,
yeah,
that free market capitalism is a freeway lane to hell, and it's already pretty damned warm around us. It doesn't work. It's predicated on being able to endlessly and relentlessly exploit resources that just aren't always going to be there. By the same token, straight up. Pure, I mean, the idea, the Marxist idea of a proletariat, you know, a dictatorship of the proletariat and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
That's 19th century thinking. You know, at least, and the stuff, the philosophies and rationales that underpinned the Declaration of Independence, if not necessarily the Constitution, were in some cases 100 years old or more. When you're talking about Rousseau, Hobbes, Locke, that crowd. And so, consequently, it was not in line with, you know, the present realities. You know, I don't have enough brains to know what the economic model will be for the future, except to say that maybe it will present itself by dint of necessity out of the ashes of what has been proven to have failed. And that's the thing we've got to get people to understand, and I think more and more people are understanding.
I got turned on to
novels in translation by Haruki Murakami.
Mm-hmm.
And in the first book that I read called Dance, 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 which goes back to the 1980s, he's sitting there describing capitalism as an abject failure. Now, he's Japanese, he's writing in Japan, but in Japan, in the late 1980s, he is describing the absolute failure, falling apart, collapsing, of capitalism. And it's not a science fiction story.
Right.
I'm seeing it in other places as well, that people are recognizing that capitalism, at least as it's envisioned by these free market, Ayn Rand, the Leo von Mises, the weirdo Ron Paul kind of crazy horse shit. That kind of thing is a failure, and it's going to lead to a massive doom. But
yeah,
the other thing that's not happening, or maybe if it is happening, it's just not happening, you know, on my radar. Maybe it's happening at Occupy. Maybe the attempt to create consensus community at Occupy is where it goes. There are a lot of people who think that. I don't know if they're right. All I know is that we are watching a failure, and you know, some sort of barbarian warlordism is no answer rising out of the ashes.
I hear you completely. I was listening to Steve Keen, Australian economist, on Tom Hartman, and he likes to call it Jonestown economics.
Yeah, that works.
Is experiencing, and I think the best answer is to just the best possible answer for now is just to keep pushing in what you believe in your convictions, for a better society. And I think you're absolutely right about capitalism failing. I mean, you go on a lot of these message board forums, and there's so many people who are rational thinkers who still think that it is Looney Tunes and tinfoil hat to question any of these economic textbooks, because they've been so ingrained in our society. This belief has become a religion that it's infected.
There,
a lot of
yes,
people.
It has become, and it's not just a religion, David. You just tapped into something very, very real. It's not just a religion. It has become an orthodoxy. And the nature of an orthodoxy is such that you cannot question its fundamental tenets.
Right, and the other thing is that because it's in that textbook, it doesn't have to be tangible. It's intangible intelligence. It doesn't matter if it doesn't exist because it's in a textbook. It's happened. This guy wrote it, and this is what's happening in our country right now. And these numbers right here are accurate. You know, when you look at that. This is a perfect example. When you look at the, I hate that unemployment rate. that percentage, because it's so psychologically, oh, it ticked down, oh, it ticked up. No, I mean, all you have to do is go outside and look at the conditions of where people are living in. Screw that unemployment rate. Screw any of those rates. Look at what the conditions of how people are living now.
Oh, by the way, I got to share something with you, because some deep background has rolled in here, David.
Yeah.
Isaac has just written in, and he said, FYI, George Clinton was the one that discovered Roger Troutman. He says, George was the one that had Roger to use the talk box, which gave Roger his trademark sound. Roger and his brother Larry Troutman stole the master recording. It was for their first album on George Clinton's new label company, and offered it to Warner Brothers record label Behind Our Back, and then followed up by saying, yeah, by the way, it must be a Dayton, Ohio thing, because it was his brother Larry who shot and killed Roger.
Right.
So, wow.
And yeah, it's
look at the depth and breadth of experience and wisdom and knowledge that's just out there plugged, and we find out because of this strange little electronic spider web of our own communications. And again, maybe that's a step toward a model.
It is building to something, and I think if we're going to continue on with this march to capitalism, then I guess we are going to have that.
The only march to capitalism that we are on is the march to capitalism's demise.
Yeah, the march to capitalism's demise, right? And then you start to wonder, like, okay, how many? Are we talking a century, 2 centuries? What are we talking here? Because it's obviously going to be quite...
Well, there will be persistent efforts to continue propping up the corpse. At this point in time, we're involved in a sort of economic weekend at Bernie's, if you know what I mean.
Right.
I'm kind of proud of that one. But, you know, we are hamstrung, David, by the world that we think we live in versus the world that we think we should live in versus the world that we probably will live in. And what I mean by that, I had a correspondence. You know, I write back and forth with tons of folks who listen to the Horn.
Right.
Because one, it really means something to me. Two, it's an extension of the conversation. Three, I get some great ideas presented to me. And sometimes I share them on the air, sometimes I don't. I had an email the other day from a longtime listener who said, you know, I consider you one of my better friends, and yet here we are. I've met you one time, but we've corresponded over the years, and I consider you one of my better friends. And that got me thinking, David.
Yeah.
And we have, within the scope of a very short time, you know, the mobilization of humanity via the automobile, mass transit, that kind of thing, basically 75 years out of the several thousand of human experience, we have come to the idea that you cannot be, and it competes, for instance, with, you know, there's no such thing as an internet romance, you know, them people doing them dirty things on the internet, it ain't never going to come to nothing. You ain't going to have no lasting relationship with nobody you ever met on the internet. God damn it, you're supposed to be down there at the bar on Friday night picking them up drunk. That's how you find a meaningful relationship. But the fact of the matter is, it isn't. Only because of the transportation revolution of the last 75 years have we come to feel like we actually have some right to know people on a face-to-face basis. And that may be part of this coming future. There was once an age where people corresponded by words written on paper. And they would cross the Atlantic, or they would cross the Pacific, and it would say, my dear so-and-so, and it would be signed, your obedient servant so-and-so. And the people would never set eyes on each other, but they would end their lives with these vast volumes of correspondence that's just full of wisdom and humanity, and they never set eyes on each other.
Mm.
So that maybe we need, you know, with the internet age, and if it is allowed to continue to live and thrive, and if the infrastructure remains in place for it, maybe we need to rethink what it means to have a relationship. Maybe we need to rethink what it means to be a friend, or to be an ally or a colleague, because it does what we have here closes distances more so than the transportation revolution did. I mean, this little radio program that's been hanging on by, you know, by its last hangnail for 6 years now, is I'm still amazed that I get emails because somebody actually listens to the program in Norway. I'm constantly amazed by the commentary that I get from Australia, from Sweden, from the UK, from Ireland, from, you know, from Greece. And wow. And it's a chance to redefine humanity and human relationships.
I think you hit on something there, because I think the problem with our society right now is we lose that sense of amazement and awe and wonder in so many things that become so secondhand to us, and we take it for granted in such a way. But if we're constantly amazed and we're constantly challenged and we constantly know that this is a privilege to have this, it makes us all the better for us.
I remember the first time I got an email from Costa Rica, or the time that Dr. Bill, when he was still doing a daily show, he got an email from Panama.
Mm.
And it just thrilled him to pieces. And it's not because we're provincial. I don't know any more of an urbane sophisticate than Dr. Bill is. But just the potential for reaching out that exists as a result of that. You know what? There is something different coming. You know, some of this has to do with watching that Nova special on you know, the cosmos over the last few weeks, and the idea that we are this gathering of particles, and yet we all see ourselves as these cohesive wholes when we're not, and. And economies that are based on false presumptions about reality, and capitalism is one of those presumptions of a false reality, because the planet is not an orange that you can is not an ever replenishing orange that you can constantly suck dry and have it fill back up with juicy goodness again. There is no abiotic oil. There's no abiotic coal. There's not a bunch of little Keebler elves working under the earth. And part of our mission going forward has to be to explain the finitude of what we're dealing with. Now, put that side by side, for instance, with that nasty old creep Jim Inhofe.
Right.
Now, this guy did an interview with, Noel Shepard of Newsbusters. You know what that outfit is, right?
Yeah, I know that.
And in giving him this interview, he said, "You might remember it was 2003 when I made the statement that the idea that man-made gases, CO2, are causing catastrophic global warming is the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the American people. I was hated at that time, but now people realize I was right." That, by the way, is the title of my book that's going to come out in January for the low, low price of $19.95 at your local Walmart. Okay, I added the low, low price in the Walmart part, but, you know, it's a pitch, it's a hustle. But did I miss the memo, David? Because I haven't heard any sane people who said that, well, damn it, Jim Inhofe was right. It's a man-made hoax, this global warming. Because the waters are still rising on that little tiny tiny island nation in the Indian Ocean, right?
Doesn't this tie in with what you were talking about of history revisionism on all sides? When they're, one of the things I was listening to on Tom Hartman was they were talking about George Washington quotes, and this woman called in and she was talking about David Barton.
Oh yeah, that.
And then Tom Hartman had to set her straight of Barton's history and his background. And it just seems that these little quotes out of context, that's the new history, and it is just accepted now rather than challenged.
And it's totally Orwellian, and of course Inhofe finishes off his little diatribe by saying, and for anyone who is of faith within this listening audience, and I know we actually do have some people that way, he finishes off by saying, "We're both doing the Lord's work, Noel." Doing the Lord's work constitutes attempting to utterly destroy God's creation.
Mm.
Huh? But again, what you know, if there's an environmental, if there's some sort of panel on Capitol Hill, and Inhofe is going to sit on it, CNN, MSNBC, Fox, you know, the usual suspects, they're all going to focus in on Jim Inhofe saying it's a hoax, man-made global warming is a hoax. And that's what's going to go out on the nightly news. And that's another one of those places where you and I and the rest of us have to reinvent media. We have to reinvent communications. We have to reinvent messaging. We have to reinvent ideas. Because the 1% media are never, ever, ever going to quit focusing on a freak show like Jim Inhofe. And, you know, that's what you see with Livestream and Occupy and them getting their message out around and underneath and around the side of and over top of the 1% for-profit media. And lo and behold, I guess people are getting the message.
Everything has to overlap together. And one last thing I wanted to mention was that on the 10th anniversary, when the horn is still on the air, you know you're going to have a convention, Bob. So you should promise one on the air. You reach 10 years, you're going to have a horn convention.
Oh, I've been wanting a horn in for so long, it's not even funny.
Well, I think 10 years is realistic, if you think about it. You're in the sixth year, you could have, like, 5 years of planning.
See, I've even got it picked out. My personal preference would be New Orleans.
Not Alabama, huh?
No. I think geographically, St. Louis or Kansas City would be a great place to do it.
Yeah, that would be great.
Or Chicago.
And
you know, when they're actually having summer.
And one last thing, when you were talking about I think this is another important thing to point out, when you were talking about audience listening, if you never pay attention to the numbers in terms of, and you don't pay attention to who's listening, as long as the airwaves are on, there's always going to be someone listening. I think we put such a focus on the fact that, well, I got to find out who's listening. But to me, it's the zen of, it's the zen of communication. Someone's always listening.
And see, that sort of ties in with the way I go about what we do here. Because people say, how many listeners you got?
Yeah.
And I'll say, you know, I'll say, I talked to Ben Burch. He tells me how many hours we're serving out. And how many people are downloading and how many, that kind of thing. I said, but the fact of the matter is, and this is another one of Bob's old stories, but way back when I was a little bitty Bob, ninth grade, I was in my first high school play. That's back when we had the arts in schools.
Mm.
And my theater teacher, caught me peeping out opening night, you know, eager little guy that I was. I was peeping at the curtain to see how big the house was. And she pulled me aside, you know, by my ear, and she said, if I ever catch you doing that again, you will never, ever, ever be in another play that I do. And I said, why? She said, because when you go out on that stage and the lights come up, you're not going to be able to see the house. And you're not going to know if there's one person or 1,000 people sitting there. And under those circumstances, if you do anything other than giving your 100% all and pouring your heart and soul into the time that you are on that stage in front of however many people are there, I don't want anything to do with you. You owe the same performance to one person as you owe to a million.
Right.
And so I try to bring that approach here. You know, we're all just family. We're all just folks. We're all just sitting around talking. And if I was obsessed, as I know some other people are, about the numbers of people listening, I'd have to walk away, because that would mean that I'm in this for the wrong reasons. And maybe that kind of, maybe it's jealousy. Maybe it's green with envy or whatever. I'm not impressed by Rush Limbaugh's $50 million a year or how much they're paying Ed Schultz. But I do think that when you start cashing paychecks like that, it does change your outlook.
Well, you know, it's interesting you bring up Ed Schultz, because the fact is that, I mean, I know Preston was talking about him, but it is fair to say this about Ed Schultz. Ed Schultz likes to intimidate and antagonize other progressives. He calls into David Sirota. He calls into other radio stations just to mock people. Now, that's his personality coming through. And that gives anyone a right to criticize someone like that. The fact that he can't deal with the fact that someone is a bit more a bit more left leaning, which is just ridiculous to me. And I see that more and more, Bob. That's the other thing.
Oh, the left is tearing itself to pieces. Well, you know, what left?
Yeah.
Whatever it is we are tearing ourselves to pieces right now. Half of us are been convinced ourselves, allowed ourselves to be convinced that Barack Obama is just like George Bush, if not worse. The other half thinks that Barack Obama shits ice cream. Okay? And there's no middle ground. And both sides are at each other's throat while the Republicans are sitting there, God damn, this is funny. I can't wait for September.
Right.
Because again, it's that principle that Wayne B. Wheeler principle of I don't need a majority, I just need a margin. Shining through again, David. You know, because, see, there is a way whereby we wind up spending the next 4 years saying two really obnoxious words, President Romney. Okay,
yeah.
There's a way that happens. By demoralizing voters, by keeping voters out of the voting booths. And, I mean, and I'll open the phones to this question. Are there actually really people out there who think that Mitt Romney would be a superior replacement to the current occupant of the White House? Is there anybody really out there that calls himself liberal or progressive who thinks that Newt Gingrich would be better for America in the White House than a second term for Barack Obama? Michelle Bachmann, same question. Herb Cain, same question. 999. Ron Paul. Man, with his creepy little Emperor Palpatine hand waving at Rick Perry. Any of them. I'll sit here and catalog Barack Obama's faults till hell freezes over.
Right.
But I'm not so godforsaken dim that I think that he's worse than Mitt Romney, worse than Newt Gingrich. What we're talking about is a continuum, a sort of a bullshit continuum, David.
Right.
Center right politics. And you know what? If the so-called left wants more leftward politics, then the so-called left, of which I suppose I'm a so-called member, needs to do a much better so-called job of getting its so-called message so-called across. And we ain't there. We're just not there.
I understand completely, and I think the big problem about it is so many progressives are focusing on these little name details of some progressives who are not marching along with everything. Like, for example, Joshua Holland and this Naomi Wolf thing about the DHS. And Joshua Holland basically saying, well, we're not a police state, but we're a diet police state. I mean, that's basically what we're saying.
Well, yeah, we're not fascist, like, you know, with the jack boots and the belts and the spiffy uniforms and the goose stepping or anything. No, we're fascism with a cross and a flag. Oh, that's better fascism.
But I mean,
there's stuff out there that gives me the creeping horrors. A story, you know, I just saw today, ACLU alleges that FBI is illegally gathering information on Muslims during community outreach. No, really? You know, no, here's the headline, FBI illegally gathering information on everybody.
Right, and I think it does more damage when somebody shuts that discussion down. I would rather be that paranoid person and never to happen than to creep, just continue to creep on going in that direction in increments.
You know, people, and I've heard a lot of it, people talk, yeah, Barack Obama, he stopped the Keystone XL pipeline. Horse feathers! Stop it! I mean, let's be a little bit reality-based. He said he would withhold his decision until when?
After the election.
Until after the election, right. So the cynics among us might say, well, you know, after the election, he can just say, well, thanks, boys, I'm reelected. Build your pipeline. Okay? So there's that. But wait, David, because here's where it gets fun. The GOP in the House of Representatives have planned to, and if they've planned to, they will. They're going to put a rider on the payroll tax cut package. You know, because Barack Obama really wants that payroll tax cut extended.
Right.
John Boehner today, and this is one of those journalism moments. It's not me just swearing for the fun of it. John Boehner referred to the payroll tax cut as chicken shit. His word, not mine. Okay. Barack Obama wants the payroll tax cut extended. Me personally, I'd just as soon see it die and then make the Congress, if they want to do something right for the middle class, make those godforsaken sons of bitches in the Republican controlled House do it or face the consequences in November, if that's possible. But here's the fun part. We are, a lot of us, myself included, looked at that, oh, okay, he's going to put it off till after the election. We know what that means. No, here's the fun one. Here's the really fun one. Like I said, the House GOP says they plan to do it, and that means that they will. They're going to put a rider on the payroll tax cut package, a rider, an amendment to it, whatever, and in the House, it will pass, okay? It's not just going to pass, David. It's not just going to pass with a Republican majority. It's going to pass with a bunch of damn, the right-of-center, the mugwump Democrats grinning like a fox eating shit out of a wire brush, voting for it. It's going to pass big in the House. What happens in the Senate? I don't know. I've got my ideas. How many members of the Senate are bought off by the coal, oil, and gas industry? It's something like 26, and a bunch of them are Democrats, okay? So here's what they're going to do. This amendment, this rider, being proposed by Representative Lee Terry, a Republican from Nebraska, will strip President Obama of his authority over whether or not the Keystone XL pipeline is approved. The authority will be then given to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And it's all just going to be wrapped up with a tidy little bow on it in the year-end House unemployment payroll tax holiday package. This is all being reported by Politico.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens then? Well, you know, because then they have forced Obama's hand, and he has to decide whether or not building the Keystone XL pipeline is more important than extending middle-class payroll tax cuts.
And there's that whole phantom of, it's going to add jobs.
Oh, yeah, there's going to be 100 million jobs building that toxic nightmare down through America that Canada could just as well easily build across its own country, except for the fact that the Canadian people won't stomach it, and the American government's already bought and paid for.
Mm.
So just kind of watch and wait and see. Do you think for an instant if that amendment from the House makes it through conference committee with the Senate, do you think for an instant that Barack Obama would veto the middle class extension of the payroll tax reduction? Do you think that he would veto that over the Keystone XL pipeline? Because there is a whole bunch of organized labor that will get back to hollering about how Barack Obama shits ice cream if he lets that pipeline get built.
Mm. It's that thinking short term again, Bob. You got to think long term.
My head's hurting. It makes me crazy to contemplate this stuff.
Well, you have a long-term good weekend, Bob.
I'm going to try, David. I'm going to try.
All right.
Take care, brother.
Bye.
Bye now. I mean, I freely acknowledge the failings. You know, Jesus Christ, this business with the FBI surveillance and stuff, the FBI is not, well, maybe it is, a law unto itself. There is some guidance coming from above. The Attorney General of the United States and the Director of the FBI, who are answerable to the President of the United States, and this surveillance crap is going on. Now, I do applaud President Obama for saying that he will veto that bill with the indefinite detention in it, but come on, really, think about that. This is a defense authorization bill that's going to have paychecks in it for troops in the field. And it's a 2012 election year. Barack Obama doesn't support the troops. Barack Obama vetoed troops getting paid. Now, I may be wrong. Maybe that's not in the bill. I hope the hell it's not. But if it is, but if they pass this pipeline business, giving it to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of the energy industry, then Barack Obama can say, well, fellas, I was all set to veto it, but Congress, you know, well, they took it away from me. Mother McCree. You know what? I need a break. It's about 20 minutes before the hour, or a little over halfway through the program this evening. And dadgummit, it's Christmas. Well, it's December, and December's in, Christmas is in December. And I've been guilty over the years of ignoring holidays. I just blow through doing the show one day in, one day out, over and over and over again. And I'm especially bad about Christmas when, you know, we ought to be playing some Christmas music and, you know, just warm, cheery, you know, the wing nuts roasting on an open fire, that kind of thing. You know, we three clods from Omaha are. So let's you know, it's the second day of December. Let's go with a Christmas carol. I've got a hell of a good Christmas carol for you. After it's played, I'll tell you a little bit more about who it is and what it is and why it is. It's a very, very secular Christmas carol. For those of you who have a real hard time with it, by the way, before we play it, and maybe this just fits, the war on Christmas is in full swing. The American Family Association has compiled a list. They call it their naughty and nice list. They got a big old list of companies that are real good about saying Merry Christmas. And whether they say it recognize Christmas enough. If the company uses the term Christmas, quote, on a regular basis, we consider that company Christmas-friendly. If a company refers to Christmas infrequently or in a single advertising medium, then they're listed as marginal and bordering on delinquency. But if a company uses Christmas sparingly in a single or unique product description, but as a company does not recognize it, well, that company is censoring or waging all-out war on Jesus' birthday, even though it was in the spring. Maybe you might want to support the companies that the American Family Association thinks ain't Christmassy enough. That would be Victoria's Secret. Woohoo! Super Value, Staples, Radio Shack, Old Navy, Office Depot, Limited Brands, L.L. Bean, Gap Stores, Foot Locker, Family Dollar. Family Dollar?! Barnes & Noble, Banana Republic. The companies that are marginal about Christmas. Dollar Tree, 1-800-Flowers.com, Bath & Body Works, Cooking.com, Hy-Vee Stores, Limited Brands, Safeway, Starbucks, UncommonGoods.com, and Whole Foods. Otherwise known as Whole Paycheck. I'm not going to bother with the list of Texas Betsy. Hanukkah, oh Hanukkah. Come light the menorah. But I, no, so if you want to support the war on Christmas, or at least oppose the fascist wrapped in a flag carrying a Bible, the fascist Christmas warmongers, even though every one of those is a huge-ass corporation that doesn't give two hoots in hell about whether you live or die, There's your companies that at least aren't bowing the fealty knee to the Wildmon cult and their American Family Association. So with that in mind, yeah, a nice, no, touching, heartwarming. First time I heard it and several times after that I heard this, tears came to my eye because it's just damn beautiful and funny. Nice secular Christmas carol. You're listening to America's listener-supported liberal voice. Emphasis on listener-supported, I might add. This is The Horn.
I really like Christmas. It's sentimental, I know, but I just really like it. I'd rather break bread with Dawkins than Desmond Tutu, to be honest. And yes, I have all of the usual objections to consumerism, to the commercialization of an ancient religion, to the westernization of a dead Palestinian press ganged into selling PlayStations and beer. But I still really like it. Forward to Christmas, though I'm not expecting a visit from Jesus. I'll be seeing my dad, my brother and sisters, my gran and my mum. They'll be drinking white wine in the sun. I'll be seeing my dad, my brother and sisters, my gran and my mum. They'll be drinking white wine in the sun. I don't go in for ancient wisdom. I don't believe just cause our ears are tenacious, it means that they're worthy. I get freaked out by churches. Some of the hymns that they sing have nice chords, but the lyrics are dodgy. And yes, I have all of the usual objections to the miseducation of children who in tax-exempt institutions are taught to externalize blame and to feel ashamed and to judge things as plain right or wrong. But I quite like the song. Expecting big presents. The old combination of socks, drops and chocolates is just fine by me. Cause I'll be seeing my dad, my brother and sisters, my gran and my mum. They'll be drinking white wine in the sun. Seeing my dad, my brother and sisters, my gran and my mom. They'll be drinking white wine in the sun. And you, my baby girl, my jet lag infant daughter, you'll be handed round the room like a puppy. Safe in this world, my sweet blue-eyed girl. And if my baby girl, when you're 21 or 31, and Christmas comes around, and you find yourself 9,000 miles from home, you'll know what. Sisters and me and your mom will be waiting for you in the sun. Whenever you come, your brothers and sisters, your aunts and your uncles, your grandparents, cousins, and me and your mom will be waiting for you in the sun. Drinking white wine. Darling, when Christmas comes. comes, we'll be waiting for you and the sun, drinking white wine in the sun, waiting for you and the sun, waiting for you, waiting. It's sentimental, I know.
You got chills? I got chills. You remember the song I played a couple of nights ago about, it was called Prejudice, the one about gingers? It's the same guy. His name is Tim Minchin. He is becoming fabulously popular in places outside of Americastan, and somewhat popular here, as made obvious by the fact that, you know, I'm playing the music. Hope he doesn't mind. Because, you see, one, it's a magnificent song. I get chills. I get little tears welling up in my little lower eyelids. Because it epitomizes the sense of togetherness that we always hope to find during the holiday season, and says so many other things about the stuff that, for instance, those filthy, godforsaken, miserable, soulless trash at the American Family Association. It says so much about what they do. You know, they put out a list. You know, were you paying attention? Yeah, of course you were. They put out a list of who isn't Christmassy enough. Because they're not saying Merry Christmas. Happy Jesus' birthday. 'Tis the reason for the season. And there, within the lyric of this magnificent song called White Wine in the Sun by Tim Minchin, is that magnificent line, or a dead Palestinian being flogged. What is it? Using a dead Palestinian to flog PlayStations and beer? That really gets to the heart of the objection, doesn't it? But that's okay, because the American Family Association that says, oh, it's Christian, by God, they're going to work, you Savior, work! And we're going to tell on anybody that isn't using you to flog PlayStations and beer. I love this song. This is a song I can listen to any time of year, but this particular time of the year, well, it's, I guess, more touching. And the line about the blue-eyed baby girl, right in the heart. Because, you know, ours are growing up. This was the last Thanksgiving, and this will be the last Christmas when all of our children are children. And you think about things like that. And then there's an added incentive to actually go out and purchase this song. If you go to iTunes and purchase it, or Amazon, or any other legitimate download sales site that's carrying the song, White Wine in the Sun, which goes for all of 99 cents, between November the 1st past and February the 1st, 2012, half of all the proceeds go to support autism research. Gee, you kind of wonder how many of the millions of dollars that has been huckstered in by the American Family Association have ever gone for anything half as worthy as that. Answer, none. No, the American Family Association digs deep when they've got an opportunity to try to make sure that a couple of guys can't pick out a China pattern, or a couple of women can't order monogrammed bathroom linens. Evil, evil, evil people. David in Tennessee, my head writer, was the one who put me on to Tim Minchin. TimMinchin.com is his website. Had I the money, and I found out he was going to be touring anywhere near here. You know, I'd like to go. Ferg, Dad, you got to take me. I'd love to take the whole family. He can get kind of racy and so forth. Who cares? They've heard the... Jesus, they go to public school. They've heard words that Tim Minchin hasn't heard yet. And I'd feel real good walking out of the theater, having had probably a darn fine time, and thinking that I had just put money in that guy's pocket. Because I'm funny that way. I believe in supporting the people who talk about and think about the stuff the way that I do. I just do. Like I said, David in Tennessee put me on to Tim Minchin. He said, yeah, that song hit me like a ton of bricks, too. It rather perfectly melds the feeling of questioning religion, loving a nice family gathering, and feeling completely uneasy with rampant consumerism. And he wrote it for his little daughter that he had found to be so revelatory in her own right. And just the very notion, you know what? A guy from New York doesn't write a song about Christmas called White Wine in the Sun. I don't know about our Australian audience, but what? Jesus, you know, it's right after the beginning of summer. You can go outside in your shorts and barefoot, and you can have white wine in the sun on Christmas Day, and I got to think that'd be awfully daggum pleasant. So, if you were of a mind to, yeah, 50% of the proceeds go to autism research, while the professed followers of the Prince of Peace use their money to foster more hate in the world. You tell me which is the more moral economic contribution. You know, economic consumer choices actually being moral choices. Not that the right wing or the corporatocracy or the 1% ever want us actually, you know, thinking that way. Dangerous, that. It's Friday on the Front Porch. It's about 2 minutes before the final hour of the program. There are a host of other stories yet to be gotten to. Things like Newt Gingrich being angry at people for eating again. Really? No kidding. Angry at people for eating all that damn food. And by the way, maybe we'll take a break coming just to keep things in orderly fashion here. But we've referenced in conversation, not me and that mouse in my pocket, but you, me, calls, emails, that kind of thing. Sandra, I think, mentioned that 91% of the American people despise Congress. That leaves 9% that like them. And ever since hearing about that statistic, I've kind of been shaking my head and scratching it a little bit here and there. And went, who in the hell thinks... Never mind who are the 1%. We know who they are. Who are the 9%? And I got something here that leads me to wonder if maybe we found them. Headline from ColeZoom.com. What the does that mean? Headline, McKinley receives Washington Coal Club's Annual Achievement Award. Really? I thought McKinley was dead. Oh, different McKinley. No, this is freshman Representative David B. McKinley Repiglickin from West Virginia, who on Wednesday became the first ever freshman member of Congress, gee willikers, to be named a recipient of the annual achievement award by the prestigious, did you hear me? I told you, it's prestigious, Washington Coal Club. So damn prestigious, I didn't even know it existed. During the black tie event at the Liaison Capitol Hill Hotel Wednesday evening, McKinley was honored due to his strong advocacy for the continued use of coal alongside House Appropriations Committee Chairman Hal Rogers of Kentucky. Let's talk a little bit about Hal Rogers. That evil son of a bitch represents the sickest, poorest congressional district in the United States, and he's a millionaire. Alongside House Appropriations Committee Chairman Hal Rogers, Senator Kent Conrad, and Dr. Janos Beer of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, they were also honored with the Lifetime Achievement Award. Now here's the pull quote from David McKinley. It is an honor to have been named a recipient of this award, and I vow to continue my dedication to the coal industry and to the West Virginians it employs. Huh. How about that? Now, he represents West Virginia's first congressional district, which takes in places like Morgantown and so forth. But he only represents, what did he say here? The coal industry and the West Virginians it employs. The rest of us can go pound sand, F ourselves, or preferably just die from the coal-fired poisons that he supports being put into our water, our air, our communities, and our bodies themselves. The Washington Coal Club is a non-profit organization consisting of individuals with a strong interest and commitment to coal production and growth. How can you have growth in something that is finite? How can you have more of something that every time you remove it, you have less of? Oh, Dr. Orwell! Members include representatives from the coal, utility, and transportation industries, as well as energy research institutions and labor unions. Did you hear that? Labor unions. That would be the UMWA. Past honorees of the award include West Virginia Representative Shelley Moore Cameltoe and the late Senator Robert C. Byrd and Jennings Randolph. So apparently this is an organization that passes out awards to West Virginia politicians who don't actually represent West Virginians, but instead represent the coal industry. Because, you know, up until almost his dying day, Robert C. Byrd was that way. Would have taken a bullet for the coal industry. Hell, my congressman, Nick Joe Rahal, jumps out of airplanes for the coal industry. Do I get a parachute this time? Well, it's a friend's a coal parachute. I'll take it! But reading this story made me wonder, is it possible, out of a population of what are we, 330 million in the United States now? Oh dear God, Bob's gonna do math on the fly. What is 9% of, well, but some of those are children, they don't vote, and some of those are folks with differently colored skin who are, try to keep them from voting. Okay, so let's say 250 million people. Okay, and that's probably on the high side. So what's 9%? What's 9% of 250? I'm sorry, I'm ciphering and doing my gazintas. Times dot O 9 equal, God damn, that's a lot of zeros. $22,500,000? You reckon that the oil, natural gas, coal, transportation, and labor unions, research institutions, and utilities, do they employ 22,500,000 people? Because that's 9%. That's now really, this is the Washington Coal Club members. They think Congress is doing a fine job, just a fine job. I think we finally found the 9%. And having found them, I don't like them any more than I did in the first place. What a sleazy, disgusting, revolting bunch. But there they are. When you see those numbers, just think, well, who would still like them? Well, the people who are getting preferential treatment from them. Want to destroy the planet? We got a Congress for you. Jim Inhofe, I'm doing God's work. Yuck. Yuck. Just yuck. He's not doing God's work. He's doing the poisoners. He's doing the work of the people who are planting the seeds of cancer in bodies all over the United States. And he feels real good about it, too. Not me, not you, not us. It's Friday on the front porch. Light them up. You know the numbers. This is the horn.
Here's Buck.
So true, David, so true. Inhofe is doing God's work. Yeah, Bob, he's doing God's work. His God. Holy prophet. P.S. Stunning bumper. Thank you, David. I was proud of that one myself. That, of course, from the Can't Buy a Thrill album. Steely Dan. And Dirty Work. Well, here we are at 10 minutes past the hour on this Friday. And see, you're all going to be walking around to the, during the weekend going, yeah, I should have called. William writing in regarding Victoria's Secret. Bob, it would be a Christmas miracle for me to get a Victoria's Secret model for a gift. Plus, I would learn quickly about life after death. Yeah, what did Richard Pryor say? Talk about on the right hand of the Lord. My daddy died. Mm-mm. Yeah, he came and went at the same time. Never forget the first time I heard that. I think I sprayed peach knee high all over the. So yeah, I think I know what you mean, William. So we march on through the remaining topics of Friday on the Front Porch. Look, I'm just gonna say this right quick. I've been dealing with some distractions here on the home front that don't bear going into, but I just ask you to bear with me for a little while. Makes it a little difficult to get behind the microphone, and it sort of does a number on my concentration. But we'll just keep going along. If I have to say any more about it, I will later. But if I sound distracted or anything, it's because there's a lot of stuff going on here and a lot of stuff on my mind. A lot of stuff on our minds here, Agnes and mine. You remember, I saw this story mentioned, and of course I'll see one story, and it'll get me to thinking about another one. You know how Michelle and Marcus Bachman raised 23 or something foster kids? She brags about it when she does her intros at the little Republican pageants. I thought about her, and they were all girls. I thought about her when I saw this story hit the news a couple of days ago. There's a draft of a new report obtained by the Government Accounting Office. Well, I guess it's the Government Accountability Office now. And it's disturbing as hell. According to this draft report, in the five states that were examined in the study, of 609 foster children and over 1,100 non-foster children, the children were taking five or more psychotropic medications at one time. Many of the drugs these children were being given are not even FDA approved for use in children. You know, antidepressants that have labels on the box saying, if you're taking this and you have sudden or increased urges to kill yourself, those kind of drugs. The mix of the drug cocktail is being referred to in the report as high-risk practice lacking sufficient scientific data. Here's the numbers for the five states. 20,000 foster and non-foster children are taking dosages that exceeded the maximum standards published in medical literature. the five states in question. And it looks like a pretty good sampling in terms of the geography of the country. The study concerned drug administration to these foster children and non-foster children in Oregon, in Florida, in Massachusetts, in Michigan, and Texas. In the foster care system in Massachusetts, almost 40% of children are taking at least one psychotropic drug. Officials at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services are kind of horrified. The head of the U.S. Administration for Children and Families wrote a letter to state Medicaid directors and said that the agency has become, quote, increasingly concerned about the safe, appropriate, and effective use of psychotropic medications among children in foster care. This is pretty horrifying, isn't it? It's frightening. It's disturbing. Well, you haven't gotten to the really good part yet. I'm just going to read to you from the text of the CBS News online story, because trying to put this in other words or paraphrase it, and there's not going to be any silly cornpone accents or anything to go with this, because this is huddle up in a corner in a little fetal ball and weep stuff. The report also found almost 4,000 foster and non-foster care infants. Now, this is not the legal meaning of the word infant. Within the law, you can refer to an infant as being anybody under the age of 18 years. For reasons of antiquated practice. That's not what this means. The report also found that almost 4,000 foster and non-foster care infants under a year old on Medicaid in five states were taking psychotropic drugs. According to the researchers, they said the risks the drugs pose to a child under a year old are, and these are their words, not well understood. I've read this story four or five times over the course of the day, and every time I read it, my innards feel like they're twisting and binding and torquing inside of me. What kind of medical professional would prescribe a psychotropic medication for a child less than a year old? What kind? I mean, we've raised babies here, you know, from birth on up. Whether we've been good parents, bad parents, or middling parents is not part of that inquiry. But when you look down at a baby in the cradle, laying there doing what babies less than a year old do, and that list is fairly short, what they do, how do you look at him and say, you know what, I think baby is depressed? Or, you know what, I think baby is hyperactive? Well, here's the short answer: you can't. There are, of course, brain dysfunctions. It is possible for a woman to give birth to a baby who is as addicted as she was at the time she carried the child to term, and it has horrible effects on the newborn. I acknowledge that. But this report seems to indicate that that's not necessarily what's going on. What's that? Baby is crying too much. Give baby a pill. Take a pill. Baby can't even take a pill at a year. Oh, wait, what? We've got Thorazine syrup now? Valium lollipops? Xanax popsicles? I don't know. Sure, bad things can happen to children that wind up putting them in foster care situations. There can be trauma, there can be PTSD, there can be real horrors. But at these numbers, and at that kind of cocktail, 5 psychotropic medications at a time when medical science doesn't even begin to understand the interactions of them? Yeah, what the hell, it's a poor kid. Jesus. I hate where this story took my mind. Because I thought about that day in that shower at Penn State University. When a little boy was up against the wall, getting it from Jerry Sandusky. When lots of little boys were up against the wall, getting it from Jerry Sandusky, and they were in a foster care program for at-risk youth. Who needs a roofie, huh, Jerry? And you wonder, if you do, probably not, why these children didn't speak out? Who's to say they weren't drugged half out of their minds? When you've got that many different psychotropic chemicals running through your bloodstream, how the hell do you know normal from Abby? What a horror. HHS guidance could help states improve oversight of psychotropic prescriptions. Okay. Broadly marked draft. Here's the sort of executive summary. Foster children in the 5 states GAO analyzed were prescribed psychotropic drugs at higher rates than non-foster children in Medicaid during 2008. The higher rates do not necessarily indicate inappropriate prescribing practices, but according to research, our experts and certain federal and state officials, they could be due in part to foster children's greater exposure to traumatic experiences and the challenges of coordinating their medical care. That's the caveat. However, prescriptions to foster children in these states were also more likely to have indicators of potential health risks. According to our experts, no evidence supports the concomitant use. Did you get that part? According to our experts, no evidence supports the concomitant use of 5 or more psychotropic drugs in adults or children. Yet hundreds of both foster and non-foster children in the 5 states had such a drug regimen. Similarly, thousands of foster and non-foster children were prescribed doses higher than the maximum levels cited in guidelines based on FDA-approved labels, which our experts said increases the potential for adverse side effects and does not typically increase the efficacy of the drugs to any significant extent. Further, thousands of infants, foster and non-foster children under 1 year old, were prescribed psychotropic drugs, which our experts said has no established use for mental health conditions in infants and could result in serious adverse effects, including metabolic and cardiovascular problems. Back up a minute. Thousands of foster and non-foster children were prescribed doses higher than the maximum levels cited in guidelines, which our experts said does not typically increase the efficacy of the drugs to any significant extent. No, it doesn't! But guess what it does do? It means that the 1% for-profit pharmaceutical industry is selling more pills! But it's okay. They're poor children. They're not Bush children. Here, honey. You want to take... Let's take your medicine. You know you like the lovely cherry flavor of Thorazine syrup. This isn't about medicine, this is about profit. Let's see. Something around 20% of foster children in Florida are on psychotropic prescriptions. Non-foster children, it looks like about 7%. Massachusetts looks about 8%. But if you're in foster care in Massachusetts, your chances are 4 in 10 or 2 in 5 that you're going to get a happy pill. Twice as many in Michigan. More than twice as many in Oregon. And Jesus, about 3 times as many in Texas. Using the language of government bureaucracy, the draft report from the GAO says, selected states monitoring programs for psychotropic drugs provided to foster children fall short of best principles guidelines published by the American Association of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. The guidelines which states are not required to follow...
Because we wouldn't want them to be having to follow the guidelines because that'd be more of that big government regulating.
Sorry, had to get a little corn pone in there sooner or later. The guidelines, which states are not required to follow, cover 4 categories: consent, oversight, consultation, and information. The states set their own guidelines for how thoroughly they will drug their foster children out of their minds.
Because that's states' rights, you understand. We got the little hellcats in the system. We didn't want them in the first place. We're spending perfectly good taxpayer money when they could be working cleaning bathrooms like Newt Gingrich says he wants them to be, which would be a lovely place for them. So we got the little hellcats in our custody, and it's the states' rights issue as to how much of the shit we give them.
David in Tennessee noting, so let's review. 20-some-odd kids cycled through the Bachman Bible Camp for the enrichment of Michelle and Mr. Closets might well have been wearing their properly fitted chemical straitjackets. Got it. Calm them down, hold them for a few years, cash the checks.
Marcus, the check cleared again. Get the prescriptions refilled. You know what we really like to do? We like to set them loose in the backyard running and shoot them in the neck with the Thorazine darts. It's really fun that way. And we've got these little darts with Jesus on them. How do you get there? How do you get to this place?
Anybody want to dredge up a little Aldous Huxley? What was the drug they took in Brave New World? Soma? Soma? Wasn't Brave New World Soma? Because I don't... yeah, because 1984 is not Soma. Brave New World is Soma. And everybody's on medication to make them able to live in the consumer culture. And yet, how many, just watch your TV, listen to your radio, how many ads will there be about America's drug problem? Right? And there will be a bunch of ads about, especially this time of year, about drunk driving. And the funny thing is that if you pay attention to the culture, you know, David from Maine was talking about art earlier. There are little warnings, and they've been with us for a while. I think about the Rolling Stones and Mother's Little Helper. Yeah? Right? You know, because you know what Mother's Little Helper was, right? Let's see if this is the... let's see if... I don't know. You know, it kind of makes sense when you think about it. That was, you know, that's Keith and Mick from, you know, the mid-1960s, the infancy of the medicating of Western culture. And once you've medicated mom and dad, well, they're going to be a little skewed if the babies aren't medicated too. So maybe you back off a little bit on medicating mom and dad, and then you just make it easier for them by drugging the kids. Jesus Christ! Babies less than a year old on antipsychotics? I know we've got people with medical backgrounds and stuff in the audience. How the f*** do you tell if a baby is psychotic? It's mind-blowing. I wish I had it handy, Randall. A clip from the Mel Brooks film High Anxiety would be appropriate.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, on the other hand, we've got, you know, we're constantly being told about the scourge of drugs in Appalachia, and mostly it's oxycodone, hydrocodone, and of course meth. And that's a scourge, and it is, and it eats people alive, and it destroys families. But you know what's funny? It didn't come in a bale from Colombia. It came in a nicely labeled bottle from a drug company. See, as far as I'm concerned, narcotic pain medications in Appalachia is the same thing as the introduction of crack to the neighborhoods of L.A. in the 80s. It has the same summary effect. But then there's an Ohio congressman, a creep by the name of Tim Schaefer. Tim Schaefer wants to break the cycle of drug-induced poverty. So he's introduced a bill that would force welfare recipients to pay for and pass a drug test before they can get any assistance. He says implementing this here bill is the compassionate thing to do. It'll end the cycle of poverty by referring drug users to treatment and providing safety for children. Children who will be made safe by drugging them out of their minds, we now see. Wow. Coming to an Ohio near you. To the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Oh, no, I just, you know, I can't even believe that story. A babe, one-year-old?
Less than.
Well, obviously, that's, you know, somebody has a contract to sell drugs. I don't see, it doesn't even make any sense, you know, except to, you know, give drugs to vulnerable babies. I really don't know, because, you know, babies don't do enough to warrant, oh, it's depressed, or he or she has bipolar disorder. What the fuck?
This story does the same thing to me, Sandra, that it did to you, because you just sit there and make, and this is not an insult to you, I'm just sitting here making little woodland creature noises. Just
I was just, you know, happily listening to your show, la la la, and then you come up with this one. I'm just like, okay.
Well, you know, it's Friday on the front porch, so I always like to end on a light note.
Well, it's just whatever. I just was like, oh my god, because I sent along to you a little photo, you know, of what, you know, just some poor child, you know, trustingly taking some drugs from who knows who, you know?
Yeah.
I'm laughing because I'm just stunned by, you know, just how depraved everything is becoming.
Right, but, you know, what better lab rats than children who have no real parents to protect them? And so once we find out it works on them...
Well, and it's just sort of, it really is one to, you know, I mean, attacking the children is always such, you know, that's it. That is just a telltale sign of, you know, a really problematic place we're living in, you know. But we should be surprised, because look at this place. Of course children would be not protected, you know.
I was looking at the picture you sent me, and I'm noticing, you notice that the little kid's eyes are about half-mast?
Well, it's just a little, you know, it's just a little sweetie pie, you know? I mean, I don't know, I'm just like, I just don't understand, how do you do it? How do you do that? This is my thing. I'm like...
Who?
In the shower,
who are the doctors?
Same thing. What happens to someone's soul and heart that you can't step in? I mean, I have a hard time not stepping in when I see some man, you know, abusing a woman, let alone, you know, children. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not like I can do anything if some man's doing that. But you understand what I'm saying? I can't just stand back. That's just not me. And if I was a professional, I am not going to be, you know, feeding kids antidepressants. Come on.
And see, if you know a little bit about the background of the pharmaceutical industry, Sandra, the creeping horrors really do set in, because you have to ask yourself, I mean, that has got to be de facto medical malpractice to give an antipsychotic to a less than one-year-old.
Yeah, I mean, okay. What happened to first do no harm and all that drivel?
No, it's first make a profit, and that's where this comes in, because anytime you sit in a doctor's office, and it always pisses me off, and if it happens to me, I'll always ask questions. You see the people with the black briefcases walk in. They're all very well dressed, and they're, oh yes, come right through. Yes, this way, please.
Yeah, you're right about that.
And it's the drug rep going in ahead of you, when you had the appointment, and they're just, you know, dropping by. So and that always pisses me off. But that's how it happens, because you know there's some really dirty stuff about the pharmaceutical industry out there, about how they award. I mean, it's like Amway. Okay, there have been schemes out there where doctors, and it's always with regard, almost always with regard to the usage of drugs that are not FDA approved for the purpose that they're hustling it for.
Yeah.
And what they do is the drug companies say, okay, doc, if you'll prescribe this drug for this thing, even though it's not FDA approved, well, you know, if you do it 10 times, we're going to buy you dinner. If you do it 50 times, we're going to send you on a golf vacation. If you do it 100 times, we're going to hire you as a speaker at our next convention in Cabo.
Right. No, I mean, you know, but the, yeah, it's just really even hard to discuss this because it's just so sick. I mean, I'll tell you this quick little story. When I was an undergraduate, I tutored, you know, some little ones for a couple of semesters, you know, working in elementary school. And, you know, I was helping out this kindergarten teacher, and, you know, I had a little one named Francisco, who was like my little favorite, really rambunctious, cutie pie. And, you know, it's whatever. I was just working with him, and he likes to do art and on and on and on. And then, you know, I hear that his family situation is, you know, less than stellar, as it is with a lot of kids. Okay, so, you know, I'm like, I come back, and it's like all of a sudden, you know, Francisco is not really the same little kid. And, you know, come to find out that poor kid's been drugged within an inch of his life.
Yeah, what David in Tennessee said a few minutes ago, it's a chemical straitjacket.
So bizarre. I was so disturbed by it, you know, that the school district, you know, has the power to do that to children, you know, under the idea that, well, if you don't do it, your kid can't attend here type of plan. And I just was like, wow, you know. Anyway, yeah, so I've always been really disturbed by the medication of especially little boys, because, I mean, a little boy, you were one, you know what I'm saying? What the hell?
Yeah.
I know, little boys.
It is a long and documentable hit. Little boy,
you know?
I mean, we've raised three little girls and we've raised one little boy. And raising the little boy was about a million times harder than raising all three of the little girls put together.
Right, but that's just, you know, the nature of the game, and the fact that you know, huge numbers of little boys in public schools are subjected to some drug or another, it's just really bizarre. And so, I'm sure it's damaging. I mean, I'm not a scientist.
The drug of choice for a long time was Ritalin, which is speed.
Yeah, and so what they say in children, it acts in the opposite mode?
Well, the theory is that in children with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, which was just hyperactive once upon a time, until the diagnosis got more, I don't know, fancy and respectable and scientific sounding, Ritalin in children with legitimate hyperactivity disorder, instead of acting like speed in them, they had an idiosyncratic reaction to it, and it acted like a downer. So it turns out that, you know, speed kills, as the old saying goes, and it ain't real good for children or anybody else. So they came up with a time released version of it, and they called it Adderall. Okay, ADD, right? Got it.
Mm-hmm.
Adderall, and it's time released, and you know, you just take one pill in the morning, Johnny. Only it turned out that when the little boys would turn into adolescent boys, some of the adolescent boys' hearts just explode.
Oh, nice.
And so, you know, we move away from that and we go into the Zolofts. And the thing is, you know, all of these antidepressant, these serotonin reuptake inhibitors, the boxes on all of them say, you know, this isn't approved for use in children, and we really don't know what it's going to do to a kid, and you really shouldn't give it to a teenager. But by the way, if you do, and they start acting suicidal, you know, seek help.
Yeah, no, and then I know that you're not really supposed to just suddenly alter taking that stuff too, because
oh no, that no, because that
more damage, right?
Right, that because that's when the, you know, hey, why don't I kill myself? Stuff sets in. So once you're on it, you're on it.
Okay, but. So if it's like that for children, as we know, you know, children's you try not to give them anything. Oh my God, it's too weird. But
See, the thing about this,
what is that doing to infants?
To the developing hardwiring brain?
Yeah, no, to everything, you know. Geez, and the nervous system, I can't even imagine what.
And again, this is a study, and it looks like they designed the study so that they wouldn't just be studying babies being drugged in Jesus land, because Massachusetts and Oregon are in there. And the numbers are a little bit different, but not a lot. But
you said the common denominator, though. They're like children at risk and impoverished. Right?
But there's nothing surprising in it, Sandra. Remember a few years ago when the Food and Drug Administration was going to give free T-shirts and a camcorder to poor people in Florida for exposing their children to toxic pesticides?
Right, yeah, no, and that popped in my mind, too. It's just sort of... Anyway, yeah.
What just knocks me for a loop is that Texas was in there, and Texas has, of course, horrible medical problems and more uninsured than any other state in the union.
Yeah.
But New York ain't in the study. Florida is not in the study. Pennsylvania is not in the study. California's not in the study. The really, really hyper-dense population centers. And the thing is, I think you can fairly extrapolate out from these five states that it's probably going on nationwide. And that's terrifying.
Yeah, no, it's incredible. But, I mean, the thing is, of course it's driven by, the need to sell these pills, I'm sure. I mean, that's what's so sick about it.
Well,
the backbone of the whole problem is that somebody is, some company is trying to make a buck.
What happens when the kid turns 18 and is no longer in the foster care system, no longer has Medicaid to provide the fix, and then goes out on the street and gets cold turkeyed whether he or she wants it or not?
Well, and maybe they might do something, but then again, then they can just be detained indefinitely. I mean, hey, I have no idea. It seems like everything's set up to,
It's frightening.
I just think that's so disgusting, babies, though. I'm like, okay.
Yeah, that was the part that ruined me. Because, I mean, granted, the science of studying infant behavior has come a long way. But I don't think any researcher of any merit would suggest that there's any way to diagnose psychotic behavior in a baby less than a year old.
Well, I mean, I just think that, I suppose maybe a segment of that whole profession are all sort of, BF Skinner wannabes. I mean, I really don't know, I mean, there's always a sick side to all that to me.
Well, it's just frightening as hell, because the response within the public school system is so frequently, your child's disruptive in class.
Well, that's all they need to say. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I saw it firsthand. That's what I mean. I saw what.
Yeah.
So,
required. Bang, you're off to the school counselor. Bang, you're off to the doctor. Boom, you're a zombie.
And the first clue is you have to have, some sort of dysfunction in the family. That's all it takes. Next thing you know, your kid is, heavily drugged. And it's just like, oh my God. Actually, I'll let you go, but I was wondering if you had heard about, there was this post at Naked Capitalism about some guy, I don't know what his name was, but he wrote about what happened to the people protesting who were arrested in Los Angeles. Did you hear about
that? No.
Oh, my God. It's straight up, these protesters were basically tortured, while they were being held. This was after they were arrested. I mean, horrible stories like locking a couple of young women in sort of cage-like structures, leaving their hand bound, too tight, wouldn't, let them just shit and piss on themselves, locking people in buses for hours on end without any food or water, just basically, just some horrific treatment. And please remember, these people are being arrested because they were doing what? Just exercising a First Amendment. I mean, I'll send you the post, because it's just stunning what's going on. Then I just read another post that the Israeli What's that one country in the Middle East?
Bahrain.
Bahrain apparently was training Alameda County pigs and other pigs in this country as far as their little Occupy Wall Street bust up.
Damn.
So, as we talk about, you know, this being a sort of world response, the global elite seem to be in unison too. So I don't know. I just was, you know, I was like, yeah. I mean, I was shocked just because, you know, I'm sort of used to being in a sovereign nation. But I think we got to shake ourselves out of that, Bob, because shit is out of control.
Well, and it's out of the box too. The like I've said before, the rubber mask is off, Sandra, and the 1%, they hold, and one wonders if they ever really have. They hold no real patriotic national allegiance. They feel, you know, the 1%, Rupert Murdoch doesn't give a damn whether he's American, Australian, or British. You know, he's a British subject. But he doesn't feel British or Australian or anything. He feels rich, and therefore he can feel much more comfort sitting down next to someone who is from a culture wildly different from him, like, say, that Saudi prince who owns 49% of News Corp. And they're they're chums, they're fast friends because they have the commonality of their wealth, Sandra.
Yeah, well, no, but the thing is that's interesting is that, you know, as this stuff, you know, the mask is being ripped off, though. I think that when you see stories about coordination like that amongst governments, you know, I just, you know, the information is out there like it's never been before. And I'm stunned by what seems to be going on, you know, where they're going to subject everyone to this austerity to wring every cent that they possibly can get out of people, destroy the welfare state. You know, I mean, it seems like a coordinated plan because in Europe, you know, they don't seem to want to do what they need to do. They prefer to create a depression, I guess. I know if you're rich and it's a depression, you can buy assets really cheaply. You know what I mean? I mean,
yeah,
it's a benefit to those people if they continue to destroy economies. So, you know, I don't really know. But when I hear that Israel, Bahrain, and Alameda County pigs are coordinated, you know, I'm troubled. Okay, I'll just leave it at that. Very troubled.
Well, and I think that's probably an understatement to say the very least. The business of that damn thing passing the Senate last night, and if the House version is actually more horrific, and that's what I heard, whatever comes out of committee is going to be a total, a total anti-constitutional, anti-citizen nightmare.
Oh, yeah, but in meanwhile, all we get to see is, you know, Shaq's 5'2" girlfriend carrying him across the stage on Jimmy Fallon's show. I mean, it's the juxtaposition is just hideous. It's like, you know, the bread and circus is in full effect, and they are seriously talking about detention and indefinite detention for Americans up in this mug.
And that's why I asked that question. You know, Obama says, "Well, I'm going to veto it." Well, if it's tied up with ongoing pay for soldiers in the field.
Well, the only reason why he wants to veto it is not because of what we're concerned about. It's because it puts a straitjacket on his executive power. Remember that. I mean, I don't know. That's the impression I get, that they're more concerned about how it alters the exploding power of the executive, not that, you know, people can be detained. So.
And like I said, couple that with the proposed legislation that would take away his ability to veto the Keystone XL pipeline and put it with FERC.
That's priceless. And also, the fact that they can't get it together, the Republicans, because there's so many of them who can't bear the idea of regular people continuing with, you know, whatever that tax.
Well, and whoever it was had to trot out Grover Norquist to speak to a bunch of those Republicans, Sandra, and say, no, imposing a higher tax burden on the middle class is not a tax increase. It's only a tax increase if it happens to the wealthy.
Well, yeah, I mean, but see, once again, the facade is just crumbling because anybody can look at this and put two and two together on this one. This is a thing. That's why the Republicans are just so exposed. It's like, wow, you really are going to fight a tax cut? Really? I mean, it's just stunning to watch. But the pressure is on them so great to maintain their representation for the rich only that they're quite happy to cut their own throats. I'm sorry. I just see. I mean, I'm not particularly for that tax cut.
Well, me either. The smart money is to just let the whole damn Bush tax cut nightmare fiasco expire.
Well, yeah. I mean, but there's a problem with the alternative minimum.
Right.
You know? I mean, they would have to fix that because that's apparently out of control. But no, I'm not interested in the sort of stealth destruction of the Social Security fund. And not only that, but they automatically are supposed to refund that from the general fund. So, you know, what is the point of this tax cut? It's all smoke and mirrors. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but if it gives Barack Obama cover to say, well, I wanted to veto it, but they took away, so we're going to build that pipeline.
No, well, yeah, there is that. I mean, I can't even, that one is just like, wow. But, I mean, nothing, you know, it's you're working from such a corrupt model now. That's the thing. You know, I mean, that's why I shake my head.
These are hypotheses founded on outright wrong positings of or unfactual positings, if that makes any sense. The assumptions upon which these hypotheses are based are just fantasy or out and out lies.
Yeah. Well. Oh. Did you have? I mean, it's a bit off. But did you look at the women for Cain thing?
Oh my God. You know I had to, right?
Oh, God, no, but that was just like, I was just gobsmacked. I thought, oh, no. And the one compared him to King David.
Oh, that was precious. And these are all just angry, husbandless women who can't get a husband, or once they get one, can't keep one.
Right.
But did you notice that, you know, he was going to make his announcement next Wednesday. Now it's been moved up to what, tomorrow?
Well, what's the announcement? That he's bowing out, right? What else could it be? I'm pressing forward. I mean, what is he going to say?
You know, if there are enough love offerings in the mail by tomorrow, press on, Herb. We're behind you.
Well, no, basically those women are saying, you know, Miss Kane, just deal with it because, you know, you'll become first lady. I mean, I don't know. What is the OJ prize that she gonna get out of?
Toaster. I'm sorry. I'm just sorry, David. I'm just jumping out the OJ prize.
So anyway, listen. I know. I'll let you go because it's just way, way, way up north. And so have a good weekend.
Yeah, I gotta get something. Gotta give here. I gotta have some weekend.
Oh my God. Okay. Bye bye.
Take care, Sandra. Bye now. OJ prize. What kind of OJ prize is she going to get? Woo! Ha! Well, we find ourselves at the point in time where we have to say goodbye for the week and goodnight for the night. And I can't wait. I hope you'll be here on Monday. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this go. Thanks to Lottie and Sparky in the chat room. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan, our blogger, Texas Betsy. Thanks to Reverbo, my head writer, David, in Tennessee. Thanks to John Fox and Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks, of course, always go out to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. Join Coal River Mountain Watch. Become a member. It's right there on the website. It's easy. And that way you'll know that you're going to be a part of the healing of Appalachia. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you. Rick Smith.